From the Sky News Centre at 6, murder squad detectives are hunting four young men over the death of a 15-year-old boy in London. He was stabbed several times outside his school in West Norwood. A second boy was knifed in the arm. Our reporter Jane Dougal, who's at the scene, says police are calling it a planned attack.
There was a car waiting outside with four black youths in it. There was a chase and the boy was stabbed to death just a few streets away from here. Now, a local shopkeeper told me that a female teacher came out and cradled the boy in her arms as he lay dying.
A gang behind a multi-million pound drug smuggling network across South Wales, Kent and Bournemouth have been jailed for a total of almost 80 years. At one point, they were responsible for supplying three quarters of all cocaine in the Swansea Valley. The Justice Minister in Cyprus says he believes an alleged spy wanted by America has fled the island. Christopher Metsos was arrested by Cypriot police in connection with an alleged Russian spy ring, but was allowed bail and then went missing. A jobless lorry driver has been convicted of trying to sell the Ritz Hotel in London for £250 million in an elaborate fraud. A court heard he'd tried to convince a potential buyer he was a close associate of the owners. Sport now, Andy Murray is in big trouble at Wimbledon. He's losing by 2 sets to love against Rafael Nadal in the semi-finals. Let's cross live to the All England Club. Our reporter Simon Owen is watching.
Yes, Murray with a mountain to climb here, but he has the edge in the third set. He's broken Nadal's serve and Murray leads by 4-2. This after Nadal took the first set 6-4, then edged the second on a tiebreak. It's been so close, but when it comes to getting the crucial breaks, they've largely been going Nadal's way. The winner of this one will meet Thomas Berdych in the final.
Football now. Holland have caused an upset, beating Brazil 2-1 in their World Cup quarter-final. Tonight, Ghana to carry the hopes of the African continent when they face Uruguay. Meanwhile, the FA has confirmed that Fabio Capello will stay on as England manager just days after leading them to World Cup failure. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
If drink is costing you more than money,
then help is just a phone call away.
Ring Alcoholics Anonymous on 0117 926 5520.
The telephones are manned 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, by volunteers who are recovering alcoholics.
So they know what the illness feels like, the loneliness, the despair.
All help is free and confidential.
So if you'd like further information, then please contact us
on 0117 926 5520.
Or you can find us in your local telephone directory.
www.alcoholics-anonymous.org.uk.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Almost 5 years ago, on the 7th of July 2005, three explosions on the London Underground and one on a bus claimed 56 lives. The attacks shocked the nation in the middle of the G8 summit at Gleneagles, and all talk of dealing with the problems of mounting debt made way with an attack that swept away all doubts about the terror threat to Britain. The terror threat was now real. But this is unfinished business. Many unanswered questions remain, and as time has passed, evidence has trickled out that entirely contradicts some of the Home Office and police version of events that day. In the absence of a public inquiry, which has been blocked by successive Attorney Generals and Prime Ministers, in the next hour we'll do our own inquiry into the 7/7 London bombings. One young man living here in Bristol who just missed out on a job offer for the government's surveillance service, GCHQ, in Cheltenham because he was away from home, was immediately suspicious about the attacks. Adrian Connock immediately set about compiling what is arguably the most comprehensive website documenting all the news articles and interviews circulating in the aftermath of the attacks. And he joins me now. Hello, Adrian, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. Glad to be here.
Now, first of all, can you remind us, where did the three attacks take place?
That would be Aldgate, Edgware Road, and the number 30 bus going to Houston.
Who were the actual, what are the names of the alleged bombers?
Shehzad Tanweer, Mohammed Siddiqui Khan, Hasib Hussein, and Jermaine Lindsay.
And what about your film, Mind the Gap? Because you made this roughly how long after the attacks?
It's almost a year afterwards.
And why did it, what really prompted you to do it?
Well, no one else was really doing it, so I took it upon myself to make the film. I'd never made a film before, but I turned out a script and got David Shaler involved and produced it quite easily, really. A lot of people wanted to help me. They saw it as an opportunity to put out views that hadn't been put out on the mainstream.
Well, thanks, Adrian. We'll be talking to you throughout the next hour. Now, Robert Webb lives just over the border from here in Wales. He lost his sister Laura that day, and I spoke to him in an exclusive interview, which I recorded earlier this year, about how the experience affected him and his family.
My name is Robert Webb. What can I say about my sister? How do you encompass a life lived very well for 29 years and which was ended so suddenly? She was probably one of the most interesting and remarkable people I think I'll ever know. And I guess that's a strange thing to say, you know, when you're only middle-aged and you expect to have a long and happy life ahead of you. But she really was very exceptional. She was very happy, vibrant, bright person. She travelled around the world twice. She had more friends than I could ever keep up with. But what's more, she never forgot birthdays or anniversaries or anything like that. So she was always around for people. She's a very, very good aunt to my two nephews. Very good daughter, obviously, for my parents. And just an all-round, generally very, very nice person to have around. I was very proud to have her as a sister. You know, we speak very often. Always made a point of, you know, whenever I was in London on business, catching up. And of course, whenever I was, you know, going to the family, you know, stay with my parents, she'd always come along, my brother and his family. And fantastic, you know, we're a good, nice family. Laura was a fantastic sister, fantastic daughter.
What did she do? Did she have a profession? Was she married?
She lived with her boyfriend, and she was a PA in an advertising agency. She'd always, you know, been interested in that area, and you know, that was the job she had, and she enjoyed it very much, and she's very well regarded by her employers.
Now, how did she get caught up in the bombing?
I could use the term wrong time, wrong place, but of course she wasn't in the wrong time and the wrong place. She was exactly where she had every right to be. She was on the way to work, like so many people caught up in it. She was going about her normal legitimate business without doing any harm to anybody. She was on the way to work. She was running slightly late, and she caught the train at King's Cross, and of course, you know, never reached her destination, which was Paddington she was aiming to get to.
So which of the bombs was she actually involved in?
It was the Edgware Road bombing, perpetrated by Mohammed Siddiqui Khan.
Now, how did you first hear that she may have been caught up?
That's a really difficult question to answer. It's a kind of, you don't get a victim list or anything like that. It's a kind of gradual realization that something's wrong. I've been at work, and obviously working in PR, you want to be checking what's going on in the world, and just caught something on the web. I think it was on the BBC about some power surges in London. It didn't seem quite right, you know, because I lived and worked in London for a long time, and I don't remember power surges. So anyway, I went off to a meeting and did a few other things and went back on, and then there was news. It looked like bombings or some kind of incident like that. And so I just rang her, which is as much an excuse just to have a chat as anything else. I hadn't seen her for a week or spoken to her for a week. So, you know, it was, oh, are you all right? Yeah, fine, right. What have you been up to? You know, that kind of thing, really. So I just got a voicemail. And then I kept trying on and off. I was doing other stuff as well. But going back to what I was saying about her being very thoughtful and person kept up, she would always respond. And she didn't. And so I began to think, well, okay, there's a bit of a problem here. Also, some of the other people I'd contacted, just see they're okay, had come back. My then boss, his daughter, was in London that day. She'd rung back saying she was all right. And so I think by early afternoon, I was beginning to get quite worried, because it wasn't like her at all. A partner was beginning to get quite worried. My mum was beginning to get quite worried. So by the end of the day, it was obvious that something was wrong. But of course, everything was really confused then. There were people in hospital, you know, their clothes had been blown off them, their identity, you know, so nobody knew who on earth they were. There were conflicting reports over casualties. People were in all kind of different hospitals as well. There was no central coordination of names of people. And I really think for the first 2-3 days, things were very, very confused. I travelled to London the next day. but it wasn't for a week that she was formally identified as being one of the dead.
So that must have been very difficult that week.
Yeah, that's something of an understatement. It was horrible. But I guess you got two choices. You can either sit back and wait for somebody to come and tell you, oh, well, we found them, you know, they're in hospital, and I'm sorry, we've identified them as one of the dead. So you can either sit back and wait for that message, or you can go out and actively look for them. And, you know, our family being our family, we went out to actively look for her. My brother and I, my then girlfriend, now wife, went into London several days on the trot, following up. You know, my brother had gone around the hospitals, you know, the night of the bombings. So we visited some of the hospitals. We had meetings with the police. In the line of work, I found it very easy to, you know, contact the media and to deal with the media, and that was a very key thing for us. I mean, from their point of view, they had ready access to the story, and from my point of view, you know, we could get her description out there. But obviously they wanted to help, you know, I mean, journalists are human beings the same as anyone else. They desperately wanted to help us find her as well. I suppose as time went on, it was looking less and less likely that she was alive and well. But again, there's that choice. Do you write somebody off, a loved one off, as being dead without having any evidence that they're dead? Or do you work on the basis that they may still be alive, however remote that possibility? And again, we worked on the basis she was still alive. We didn't give up on her right until the end, when her body, you know, it was confirmed that her body had been found.
I know some of the families were really angry, and some even went to the extent of going round London on lampposts, putting up photographs of their loved ones. I mean, did you have any sympathy with their anger?
It depends where you direct your anger, doesn't it? I guess at the time I was frustrated. I felt that the authorities should be able to, you know, wave a magic wand and they would know. But, you know, you look back on it in hindsight and you look at the enormity. 4 major bombing incidents in a major capital city. Huge amount of confusion. The 3 on the underground survivors had come out from different stations, so there was a confusion over, you know, where the bombings had taken place. Then, you know, without wanting to go into too much detail for, you know, kind of like a pre-watershed audience, there's an awful lot of forensic work and picking around to do. These were bombs. There was shrapnel from the bombs, there was shrapnel in the train. Frankly, it was, you know, like, I think maybe leave it to people's imaginations how difficult it's going to be to investigate a bombing like that. Also, they needed to understand who the perpetrators were, and, you know, when you know, it became apparent to the authorities that it was suicide bombings, they needed to identify the people quickly and, you know, do the necessary investigation work. You know, was there anyone else involved? So that work had to be done. So, yes, it was frustrating. There's a lot of anger, I think, I have towards the bombers, but none towards the authorities in the way that they responded. I know that lessons have been learned. I think things could probably have been done better, but can we really blame or condemn anybody for the way in which they handled an incident like that? I wouldn't, no.
Are you satisfied then with the subsequent judicial process of finding responsibility?
I think we've got to be clear about separate responsibility from the judicial process. As far as I'm concerned, the responsibility rests with 4 named people, and those were the 4 bombers, and anybody unnamed, unidentified, who may have assisted them in that, or inspired them, or encouraged them, or anything like that. That's it. As the humans, we have a choice. They made a conscious decision to go out and kill and maim innocent people. They're the ones who are responsible for this. In terms of a wider investigation as to what things that we as a society can learn, could the bombings have been prevented through better intelligence and security work? Could we learn lessons in terms of, you know, the way in which, you know, people can get bombs onto trains and buses, and the communication between the security, you know, the emergency response services after the incidents. Yes, I think there's a lot of work that could be done. I think there have been a number of investigations and reports so far. I think the Greater London Assembly have done a good job. I feel that the government's ones are skirting around the real issue, and the real issue is that we do need an independent inquiry to see just what was known prior to the bombings. Because if you look at the initial Intelligence and Security Committee report, that didn't reflect the revelations from the so-called Crevice trial, which came later, that far from being clean skins, as the government had described the bombers early on, they were, you know, a number of them were known to the authorities. And in fact, Khan, Siddiqui Khan, the man who killed my sister, had been followed home by security officers, had been photographed as well. I obviously have concerns about that, not only, you know, from a strictly, you know, from a personal, quite selfish point of view, that, you know, I would have wanted the death of my sister to be prevented. But there are 51 other people who died as well, and we should never forget that. Nearly 800 people were injured by the bombs. And also, of course, this kind of thing could happen in the future, and I would want to be satisfied that we can learn the lessons, and if these things can be prevented in the future, so, you know, that'd be great. And I have to say, I mean, you know, sort of touch wood in every prayer that I can, you know, it's been nearly 5 years now and there hasn't been a successful attack, you know, and I think that does reflect well.
Yeah, you say an independent inquiry. Do you think when you say independent, how can you guarantee that an inquiry is going to be actually independent?
Well, it's got to be independent of the government. I mean, we can mess around with semantics about how you define independent. Independent of government would suit me, along the lines of many of, you know, inquiries in the past, whether that's headed by, you know, a judge or something like that, or whether, I mean, the Home Affairs Select Committee are looking at it now, and that's independent of government, as we've seen from their conclusions. Those conclusions have been distinctly uncomfortable for governments in the past, and so I'm happy that they're looking into it, and I'd be interested to see what they conclude.
So 5 years on, how has this left you feeling, the experience?
I think anyone who loses a loved one is scarred, you know. Even if we lose a loved one, you know, at kind of like the right age, and they've had a long, happy and fruitful life, it's still sad. My father died before my daughter was born, and, you know, I'm still sad that although my father, you know, died naturally, you know, in his 80s, I'm still sorry that he never met his granddaughter. I'm still sorry that he's not around to speak to now, and that's a natural grief that we all have. When you lose somebody long, long before their time, you know, say a road accident or something else, you know, I mean, that would make you feel very, very raw. It's very, very upsetting. But when you lose somebody as a result of murder, a premeditated attack on innocent people, then I don't think you ever really get over a death or recover. You're not quite the same person afterwards. You kind of learn from it. But this is something 5 years on, I'm not able to forgive the people behind it. And, you know, I am angry that my sister didn't have the long, happy and enjoyable life that she deserved and that she should have had.
Have you seen enough evidence to satisfy you that the police have done their job correctly in identifying these four bombers?
There's some things, you know, there's some conversations we've had, you know, you can't really, you know, sort of discuss, but I'm happy that they've identified the people concerned. There's been a lot of good work done by journalists following up some of the stories behind the bombers. You have, of course, the two suicide videos, including the ones from Khan. So I'm satisfied they've identified the right people. I know there hasn't been a judicial process which has, you know, actually said X was responsible and stuff like that, but I've got no reason to believe that they've got it wrong, and I've got no reason to believe that you know there's any particular conspiracy or anything behind that. As far as I'm concerned, it's open and shut. The country was on a state of alert for you know, a terrorist attack from Islamic extremists. Suicide bombings, regretfully, are a way that some have decided to pervert Islam by saying that suicide bombings are a good thing to do and would lead to a reward. So suicide bombings are entirely consistent with the way that this, some of these people operate. And as I say, the four people concerned have been identified to my satisfaction, certainly.
Because one of the things that many people have pointed out is that there really aren't any CCTV pictures actually putting these four guys on those trains. And even with the bus bomb, we were told that unfortunately the CCTV cameras on the bus weren't working, so we haven't seen any pictures of the bus bomber, alleged bus bomber, on the bus. Does that bother you?
I think what you've got to realise is that due legal process is not complete yet. I mean, I think we've got kind of appetite in this country where we expect to have everything now, and that doesn't always happen. And when you've got ongoing criminal investigation, which of course was only actually concluded last year, there were, you know, another three people put on trial for allegedly assisting with the bombings, and there was a lot more information came out as a result of that. Now, okay, they're found not guilty, but there was a lot more information came out as a result, and that had to be held back because it could prejudice the trial. We haven't had the inquests yet, and again, you can't prejudice the inquests. There is going to be more information, I'm sure, will come out, you know, in due course. I'm sure further CCTV footage beyond what we've already seen, which of course is quite substantial, will come out. But I understand fully that some things have got to be kept back pending any future inquiries.
That was Robert Webb there speaking to me earlier this year, and he lost his daughter Laura in the Edgware. Sorry, his sister Laura in the Edgware Road blast. Now, many survivors and families are not satisfied by Sir Ian Blair's press conference a few days after the attacks announcing who did it, nor the so-called Home Office narrative, which was published 10 months after the attacks. Last month, this year, when it was announced that inquests without juries would take place into the deaths, the solicitor for the survivors, some who felt sidelined by the process, organised a press conference.
We hope now that the Home Secretary will withdraw her opposition to a judicial investigation, and that at last the survivors, all of those affected by the London bombings, will be able to have the answers they want. There is relief that she has adjourned the inquests, or the decision into whether to resume the inquests of the bombers, so that these 52 inquests will now take place without the inquests of the other four being joined to them. And it's right to say, finally, that there is a degree of disappointment. That disappointment comes from the survivors. The survivors were forced into a campaign for an inquiry simply because successive Home Secretaries refused it. An awful lot of pain and grief could have been avoided if 3 years ago, when we first asked for it, the government had decided to hold a public inquiry. But there is now a relief that the inquest will be held. They wanted to play a more active part in it, but they have been told that they cannot do so. And you may remember at the conclusion of the preliminary hearings, Rachel North, who had been one of the many campaigners for an inquiry, asked for a statement to be read out, and I will read to you, if I may, one paragraph from it, because this sums up, I think, the views of each and every one of the survivors. She said this: "It appears to me that if you are a member of the public who is unfortunate enough to survive a terrorist atrocity, then no matter how much your pain, your physical and or mental injuries cause you, no matter how much your life is blighted, no matter how much your health, career, personal life, relationships, family, sense of self is affected, no matter whether you become suicidal, no matter how much your life is changed, reduced and damaged, you will have no right to ask questions about what happened to you and to expect answers to be given to you. You may be called as a witness for the benefit of others, but that is all. You may not see documents or ask questions. You may not expect a public inquiry. You should just be quiet and be grateful that you are alive." Gentlemen, ladies, that's all I want to say. I will take questions. More importantly, it's the views of those sitting alongside me that you want to hear, and they have agreed to take questions from you.
Alistair Bunk of Sky News. Perhaps we can pick up on the final point you made there, and I address this question to the survivors. You're not going to be able to have legal representation at the inquest. What do you feel that you would have brought to the inquest had that decision been your way?
We have questions that need answering. We were allowed to submit some questions to the Intelligence and Security Committee, but those questions were not answered. We want assurances about recommendations that will be made. We have our role now will be one of answering questions only, which we will do willingly, but our questions are not going to be answered unless they're asked by someone else who's one of the bereaved. We've been shunted aside by officialdom, and those questions may or may not be answered. And those questions need to be answered because it does involve the safety of everyone who travels on public transport or goes to any public place.
So do you feel the inquest would be less effective as a result?
I hope it won't be. I really hope it won't be. And it's very important that we'll remember that the inquests are for the families and the loved ones of those who died. But this is our only voice. We've been led to believe that this would be an opportunity for us to have a voice, and now we don't.
That was a press conference organised by the Solicitor for Survivors of the 7/7 London bombings just about a month ago. Now, Adrian Connock is joining me, a filmmaker. We have questions, she says. The questions have not been answered, and she's actually saying there the survivors have been shunted aside.
Well, that's right. Lady Justice Hallett, of the member of the Honourable Society of the Inner Temple, who's in charge of the coroner's inquest, has not granted any of the survivors interested person status, which would give them the right to question witnesses and to access the evidence. So that is why they're quite upset about that. She has also refused to call an independent jury into the inquest, and this is due to the apparent sensitivity of the intelligence material. So it seems the survivors are not getting access that they want, and the security services are being protected.
Now, Martin, there is a possibility here that this is a false flag attack. Would you like to just explain what a false flag is and what the origin of the expression is?
The term false flag comes from 18th century naval warfare, because this is in the days before telecommunications or whatever. So a ship would sail towards the enemy but flying their flag so that they think it's that one of their friends, and then when they get up close, they suddenly run up their own flag and open fire. So a false flag terrorist attack is a terrorist attack that's ostensibly carried out by one group but is in fact being used to frame another group. And the classic example might be the burning of the Reichstag in the 1930s, which was blamed on the communists, and then Hitler was able to round up all of the communists because the Reichstag was burned down, although subsequent historical investigation has suggested it wasn't actually the communists who burned down the Reichstag, it was probably somebody associated with Hitler himself. So you can see how these kind of things can work. And of course, the all around the world, large numbers of people are convinced that the September the 11th attacks in 2001 in the United States were potentially a false flag attack.
But what
and that includes members of the Russian General Staff, for example.
But what might be a potential motive for a false flag attack in the London bombings case?
Well, as the contributors have pointed out, this is the only major terrorist attack that's taken place. And if no terrorist attacks take place, people might start to question whether there is a terrorist threat or there isn't a terrorist threat. I think we need to look back to the 1980s, when a lot of these jihadist groups were founded with the help of the Western security services. There's no doubt about that. That's a matter of historical record. MI6, the CIA, in collaboration with Mossad in the background, set up an awful lot of jihadi terrorist groups to fight in Afghanistan. Now, you could see this as potentially blowback. We've created a Frankenstein's monster, and it's now out of our control. But of course, many people around the world outside of middle class England they think, actually, you may still be in control of these terrorist groups and that you're actually creating these kind of events. For example, we saw the bombing of Bologna railway station in 1980. Italian parliamentary inquiry has definitely shown that that was carried out by their own security forces in order to create a strategia di tensione, a creation of tension, a creation of fear, so that certain political goals can be fulfilled. Now, I'm not saying that that's what did happen on 7/7, but it's a perfectly logical thing to ask, is this what's going on? And that's what an inquiry might help to uncover.
Well, one of the things that definitely mitigates against that is the suicide videos, Adrian. What about those?
Well, the one of Khan, the lip sync, is out. And, of course, these videos just come from unknown provenance. We don't really know the source. They're released on Al Jazeera. They haven't been scrutinised in any kind of court. None of the evidence, in fact, against the men has actually been scrutinised in a court. And so it is possible these videos were made under some other pretense. And people should remember that the actual bombings in London are not mentioned in either video by Khan or Tanweer. So for me, I don't think they would be admissible in a court of law as conclusive evidence.
Can I just make the further point that nobody's suggesting here that these chaps might not have been genuine jihadi terrorists? They may or may not have been. But the way false flag terrorism works is that you have patsies who are put in the frame to look as if they did it, but in actual fact the actual bombing is done by somebody else. So we had the 19 terrorists who supposedly hijacked planes on September the 11th, and they crashed the planes into the buildings. But the suggestion is, because nanothermite has been found in the rubble by investigators from Copenhagen University, that the so-called 19 hijackers and the planes are a diversion from the actual bombing of the three buildings that went down on September the 11th, including the building 7. Now, because we're living in a universe where false flag terrorism is going on, in Turkey the police have arrested a lot of their top generals for false flag terrorist offences, it's legitimate, and certainly within the Muslim community, as you well know, Tony, questions are being asked about whether this is a false flag terrorist event of a kind which is very common in Pakistan, where many Muslims come from. Middle England very rarely gets bombed, so they always take the straightforward explanation of which they're presented with. Other parts of the world get bombed all the time, and they get a much more sophisticated analysis of what might be happening.
Right, let's go back to 2005 and to the day itself. The Guardian's Mark Honingsbaum rushed straight down to the scene of the Edgware Road underground blast and filed this audio report for the Guardian website, where he talks about the bomb being under the train and the floor tiles having been lifted up.
This is Mark Honigsbaum reporting from the London Hilton Hotel opposite Edgware Road Station, where we believe there was an explosion this morning under the carriage of a train. I've been speaking to survivors all morning. People were evacuated, first of all, to Marks and Spencer's beside the underground, and then across the road to the London Hilton, where there are some people in very, very bad injuries. There was a woman who got cuts and burns to her face and is being wrapped from head to neck in bandages. There's people with blood cuts. But, I mean, the main thing is people are extremely shook up still. What seems to have happened is that sometime around 9:30 this morning, passengers in a train from Edgware Road travelling to Paddington, they'd just left Edgware Road Station when suddenly they felt they had a massive explosion. And some passengers described how the tiles, the covers on the floor of the train suddenly flew up, raised up, and the next thing they know, there was another almighty crash, which they now believe was a train travelling in the opposite direction, hitting their train, which had been derailed by this explosion.
That was Guardian's Mark Honingsbaum reporting on the 7th of July 2005 itself from the site of the attack at the Edgware Road tube bomb. Now, he actually does say there that the bomb was underneath the train, and yet in the article which actually appeared in the next day's Guardian, he was saying that the bomb was inside the train. And I actually phoned up Mark Honingsbaum about 2-3 weeks after the attacks and asked him why there was a discrepancy, and he said to me, "Well, Tony, all I can say is not everything I submit in copy ends up in the next day's newspaper." So that's certainly a sort of unexplained thing. But what does it really tell us, do you think, if the floor tiles are lifted up? Surely, you know, if it was a suicide bomber in there, Adrian, that might happen too.
Well, absolutely, that might be the case. I mean, first of all, we should point out that's not the only source. Other witnesses, for example, Bruce Late, is quoted as saying, "The policeman said, 'Mind that hole, that's where the bomb was.' The metal was pushed upwards as if the bomb was underneath the train." So, of course, you know, I'm not an expert on what happens when bombs go off, but coupled with the police saying that the bombs were definitely placed on the ground, and most of the injuries are lower body injuries. People saying, another quote here from Angelo Power, "People were physically ejected from their seats, so that would certainly implicate some kind of force from underneath. The tiles on the floor of my carriage suddenly shot up, Anita Kingsley," and it goes on and on. So, coupled together with these bits of evidence, it is possible, I think feasible, to speculate that the bombs may have been underneath the train. And we should remember that back in the Intelligence Security Report of 06, they actually state that they are not certain that the men actually detonated the bombs. And I should also point you to the coroner's inquest of 2010, where they are talking about assessing the likely development of assembly of the explosive devices in regard to the four men. So in other words, they're not actually sure that they actually developed the explosive devices, and they're not certain they actually detonated them. So I think it is, it's free to speculate, really.
The names of the four alleged bombers were announced by the Chief Constable of Metropolitan Police, Sir Ian Blair, on Tuesday, July the 12th, and almost a year later, the Home Office issued a narrative of what happened. But almost immediately, people began to pick it apart and found some fundamental errors. Now, Adrian, this whole business of the train times, can you just explain that? Because apparently the train time given in the government official account turned out to be nonsense.
Well, that's right. For over a year, the press and the police were reporting that they caught the 7:40 train from Luton to Thames Link King's Cross. That actually turned out that the train didn't actually run that day. And it was John Reid that actually amended this in July of 2006, saying that the police had actually got that wrong, and it was apparently actually the 7:25 that they caught. This puts a few problems in the official timeline, because to get to the first explosion, some researchers have been down there and actually suggest that the men could not have had time to have made it if they'd caught this earlier train.
Now, one of the things I'm really surprised about, though, is that there still is no conclusive evidence as to whether the explosives used were a military type of explosive or a homemade explosive.
Well, that's right. I mean, the only thing we've had is the Intelligence Security Committee report of 06 saying that they were peroxide-based devices. But there's been, I mean, if you go into my website, officialconfusion.com, and click on the explosives link on the left, you can read a collage of media reports that all contradict each other about the type of detonation, about the type of explosives. And certainly the witness reports and the damage and the injuries seem to be synonymous with C4 explosives rather than some kind of peroxide-based device. And the inquest of 2010, the coroner's inquest, there is a report now being prepared at the moment about the explosive devices, so perhaps we will learn more over the coming months.
Now, we heard from Robert Webb earlier that he was rather annoyed that MI5 admitted afterwards that they had been putting Mohammed Siddiqui Khan under surveillance. He had been for some time, and it is possible that he was even an MI5 informant. Anyway, let's have a little listen now to a report about that.
Information just this week from the United States saying that the US tipped off the British authorities about Mohammed Siddiqui Khan anyway, and then there was the original sort of admission, which came quite late, from the security services here, that they were aware of him and that they'd been following him tangential to another investigation. I mean, it does all mount up, it seems, over time, that there was more and more information there.
No, that's right, and I don't think, again, that's a surprise to people who actually worked in the industry, if you like, of intelligence. It was always going to be highly improbable that somebody comes straight out as what the media was calling a clean skin and suddenly becomes a suicide bomber.
Well, the media, led on by briefings from the authorities.
I think that's absolutely right, and there was a good reason for that, I'm sure, which was, from their perspective anyway, which was, of course, if these are clean skins, how can we blame the security services for not having been on their trail? As it's turned out, as I think was predictable and predicted, this has turned out to be not the case. The level of information that was coming in about Khan, particularly if these American reports especially, which now seem to be being backed up by the actual American authorities, not just appearing in an author's book, that they tipped off the British about the specifics of Khan. And this was quite a serious plot in the United States that we were talking about, an attempt to blow up synagogues and so on. The amount of information coming in and the quality of information coming in, the fact that that has been so consistently overlooked, it would appear, by the security service MI5, to me suggests really only one of two options. Either A, we've got a level of incompetence that would be unusual even for the security service, but B, possibly, and this is a possibility, that this man Khan may even have been working as an informant for the security service. It's difficult otherwise to see how it can be that they've so covered his tracks in the interim.
That was intelligence analyst Charles Shoebridge speaking on the BBC World Service. And now we're going to have a listen to John Loftus, who is also an intelligence analyst. And here he is speaking about Abu Hamza and someone who is believed may have been the mastermind. Now, just before we have a listen to that, Adrian, who is this chap, Haroon Aswat, who many people believe may have been the mastermind of the attacks?
Well, that is a confusing question, because there are disputes as to who Aswat actually is, because there are several people.
Well, he was an aide to an assistant to Abu Hamza.
Well, that's correct, but I mean, in his history in terrorism is confounded by confusion, because there are other Aswats that possibly have been linked to his name. So
now, wasn't he in touch with these alleged bombers in the weeks running up to the attacks?
Well, in the weeks running up to, it's been reported, and actually on the morning by ITN, The Times and other mainstream journalists, that he had phone calls with the men. I mean, what's significant about this is the trial, recent trial last year of Salim, Shakil and Ali, who also had contact with the alleged bombers. They were on trial specifically because they had contact with these men. And why is Haroon Aswat still in a jail? He's been sitting there for 5 years. The press reported that he had contact with the men. This is not denied by the Intelligence Security Committee report. And so why was there a trial for those three men and no trial for Aswat, who just sits in a prison? And basically, we've been told that he has nothing to do with 7-7, even though these connections have not been refuted and appear to be true. So therefore, why is there no investigation or trial to do with these connections with the men?
Okay, well, let's have a listen now to John Loftus talking about this potential real mastermind behind the attacks, Haroon Aswat.
Yeah, all of these guys seem to be going back to an organization called Al-Muhajirun, which means the emigrants. It was the recruiting arm of Al-Qaeda in London. They specialized in recruiting kids whose families had emigrated to Britain, but who had British passports. And they would use them for terrorist work. But what they had in common was they were all emigrant groups in Britain recruited by this Al-Muhajirun group. They were headed by, Captain Hook, the imam in London, the Finsbury right. Mosque. Without the arm. He was the head of that organization. Now, his assistant was a guy named Aswat. Haroon Rashid Aswat.
Aswat.
Aswat is believed to be the mastermind of all the bombings in London.
From on the 7-7 and 7-21, this is the guy, we think.
This is the guy, and what's really embarrassing is that the entire British police are out chasing him. And one wing of the British government, MI6, or the British Secret Service,
right.
has been hiding him. And this has been a real source of contention between CIA,
Hold on, John.
Justice Department, and Britain.
MI6 has been hiding him. Are you saying that he has been working for them?
Oh, I'm not saying it. This is what the Muslim Sheikh said in an interview in a British newspaper back in 2001.
So he's a double agent, or what?
He's a double agent.
He's working for the Brits to try to give them information about Al-Qaeda, but in reality, he's still an Al-Qaeda operative.
Yeah. The CIA and the Israelis all accused MI6 of letting all these terrorists live in London, not because they were getting Al-Qaeda information, but for appeasement. It was one of those, you leave us alone, we leave you alone kind of things.
Well, we left them alone too long then.
Absolutely. Now, we knew about this guy Aswat back in 1999. He came to America. The Justice Department wanted to indict him in Seattle because him and his buddy were trying to set up a terrorist training school in Oregon.
So they indicted the buddy, right? But why didn't they indict him?
Well, it comes out, we've just learned that the headquarters of the U.S. Justice Department ordered the Seattle prosecutors not to touch Aswat.
Hello. Now, hold on. Why?
And that's, well, apparently Aswat was working for British intelligence. Now, Aswat's boss, the one-armed Captain Hook, he gets indicted 2 years later. So the guy above him and below him get indicted, but not Aswat. Now, there's a split of opinion within U.S. intelligence. Some people say that the British intelligence fibbed to us. They told us that Aswat was dead, and that's why the New York group dropped the case. That's not what most of the Justice Department thinks. They think that it was just, again, covering up for this very publicly affiliated guy with Al-Mujarun. He was a British intelligence plant. So all of a sudden, he disappears. He's in South Africa. We think he's dead. We don't know he's down there. Last month, the South African Secret Service come across the guy.
Yeah, now the CIA says, oh, he's alive. Our CIA says, okay, let's arrest him. But the Brits say no again?
The Brits say no. Now, at this point, 2 weeks ago, the Brits know that the CIA wants to get a hold of Haroon. So what happens? He takes off again, goes right to London. He isn't arrested when he lands. He isn't arrested when he leaves.
Even though he's on a watch list.
He's on the watch list. The only reason he could get away with that was if he was working for British intelligence. He was a wanted man.
And then takes off the day before the bombings, as I understand it?
Yeah, and goes to Pakistan. The Pakistanis arrest
him. They jail him.
They jail him. He's released within 24 hours, back to Southern Africa, goes through Zimbabwe, and is arrested in Zambia. Now the U.S., we're trying to get our hands on this guy.
Zambia, Pakistan, arrest Haroon Aswat. This guy seems to have a get-out-of-jail-free card, even though he's the best mate of Abu Hamza from Al-Mujarun, the supposedly most dangerous terrorist organisation in the West. Martin?
Yes, I mean, what we're looking at here, I mean, it's very hard to find out what's actually happening, but what I would like the listeners to take on board is that you haven't heard the full story about what's happened here. We clearly haven't heard the full story. And people do need to understand that, A, the security services may be incompetent and they may be covering up because they're trying to cover up their incompetence in this matter, or B, the possibility that they are in fact implicated in this matter. Nobody in Pakistan doubts for a moment that the intelligence services, the inter-service intelligence agency in Pakistan, is implicated in terrorism. Nobody in Belfast presumes that the British intelligence services were not implicated in terrorism. The Omar bomb, for example, Kevin Barrett, who was the British intelligence informer inside the Real IRA, gave clear knowledge of where that bomb was going to be planted. The bomb went through and went off. And the Nuala O'Loan, the head of the Police Investigation Authority in Northern Ireland, said that she's never been happy with the government's explanation of what happened to Omar. Now, of course, if you live in a permanent state of war, as people in Northern Ireland or Pakistan do, you don't take things at face value. You don't take things for granted. We've only had one major attack in Britain and people are not used to it. They may have to get used to the idea that just as at Bologna or as at Dublin and Monaghan in 1972 or Bologna in 1980 or has been happening in Turkey for 30 years, it may be our own security services, MI6, which are actually helping these terrorists to carry out their acts, because there's a political agenda behind this, which is to do with oil, which is to do with money, which is to do with imperial power.
Almost all roads in the 7-7 case seem to lead back to Britain's internal counterintelligence security service, MI5, whose job it is to stop terrorists and foreign spies operating here in Britain. The only problem is, MI5 refuses to answer questions, either in the courts or in the press, saying it may damage national security. So what really goes on there at MI5's headquarters, Thames House, at the north side of Lambeth Bridge in London? All their activities are shrouded in a cloak of total secrecy. But all is not lost. Last year, an MI5 officer and whistleblower, Annie Machon, described the inner workings of MI5 when she spoke in Canada about why her and her partner decided they could not, in all conscience, continue to work there.
David Shaler and I met in our first section, which was the political subversion section, which we helped to shut down, actually. And we were both in MI5 for about 6 years. And during that time, in three different postings each, we just saw incrementally things getting worse and worse in terms of bombings that could and should have been prevented, in terms of illegal phone taps and operations, and crucially in terms of two false flag terrorist attacks. The first of which was in London in 1994, when the Israeli embassy was car bombed in a very smart part of London. And this was blamed on two innocent Palestinians who were arrested, charged and convicted of conspiracy to cause this attack. And they were both sentenced to 20 years each for this attack. And it turned out in the assessment of MI5, the senior officer in charge of the investigation, who'd seen all the evidence and all the intelligence, his assessment was that Mossad had bombed their own embassy in a controlled explosion. One, to gain increased security around Jewish interests in London, but primarily to shatter a Palestinian political network, which was growing very fast in London, and of which these two were members. So that was the first case, and that really made us sit up and think about what we got ourselves into. But the primary case was an assassination attempt against Colonel Gaddafi of Libya, and this happened in 1996. And in this case, it was an Islamic extremist terrorist group which was paid by MI6, which is the external intelligence agency. It's the sort of James Bond wing of British intelligence. And they paid money to this group to try and assassinate Gaddafi. And they'd done it illegally under UK law because they hadn't gained the permission of their political masters. They can actually get the license to kill if they get prior written permission for illegal acts abroad. And the attack obviously went wrong. Gaddafi is still very much alive, but innocent people died. So this was the thing, this was the case that made David Shaler and I quit. We couldn't think of anything more heinous than the British state, the British intelligence agencies, actually funding a group with Al-Qaeda connections to try and assassinate someone illegally and kill innocent people. So we decided to leave. We hadn't signed up to work for the British intelligence community in order to get involved in organizations that committed terrorism and killed innocent people. So we left. And in 1997, we ended up going public about our concerns about these crimes. And in fact, we ended up going to the newspapers, because under UK law, there's a piece of legislation called the Official Secrets Act, which makes it a crime to report a crime if you are an intelligence officer. So even though we were saying the spies have committed murder, we were the criminals by even saying that, and there was no investigation into MI6's murder attempt against Colonel Gaddafi. So we went to the press in order to, one, try and get enough attention to force an inquiry into this assassination attempt, but two, also for protection for ourselves. And we ended up blowing the whistle and having to go on the run around Europe.
Annie Machon, whistleblower there, an ex-MI5 officer. So who are the MI5 officers responsible for stopping the kinds of attacks like 7/7 happening here in Britain? What kind of people are they? Here's Annie Machon again.
Last year in MI5, I was actually trained up to be a recruiter. This was the first year in which they were openly trying to recruit people. They were advertising for them in the media and saying, would you like to work for MI5? And they got flooded with applicants, about 20,000 in the first round, of which they chose five. So they had their pick of good graduates. And the sort of things they were looking for were obviously intelligence, mental intelligence, good analytical skills, good communication skills, and the ability to influence other people. So if you went out into the field and had to deal with agents, they would trust you. But also things like tenacity and an ethical framework within which you worked. So basically they wanted everything. They wanted a very rounded human being who could do a wide variety of work. And because they were MI5, and because they sounded glamorous, and because they never told the recruits exactly what they'd be getting up to when they joined, they got those sort of people. What they then found, of course, was they couldn't retain them.
One of the most common misconceptions is that people muddle up intelligence officers and intelligence agents. Annie explains the difference, and crucially, what tricks they use to get agents and others to do what they want them to do.
They have intelligence officers who are full-time employees who organise the operations, run the operations and assess the information that comes out of them. And that's what I was. So you work for MI5. The people you're talking about are then defined as agents. So they don't work. They're sort of like contractors. And they are employed by MI5 to infiltrate organisations or to go and bug people's houses or whatever. So they're the sort of cutouts. They are the ones who do have to befriend people in groups, are the ones who betray those friendships and report back. And it's an interesting psychological study of why people will do that. MI5 always had this thing which they had a little acronym for, which was MICE, which was money, idealism, compromise and ego. So you could buy someone to do it, they would do it for ideological belief, you caught them out in an embarrassing situation and blackmailed them, or you flattered them. You basically said, come on, do something really good. We know you can do it and nobody else can. Mm-hmm. So that was how they got the agents to infiltrate these groups. However, in the UK, what we've seen worryingly in the last few years is a sort of explosion in private security firms as well. In the US, notoriously, we have Blackwater, which has gone into Iraq and murdered people with legal impunity. But in the UK, we have other companies like Kroll or Diligence, which in fact was set up by one of my ex-colleagues and is doing very well. And they get paid by big corporations primarily to go and spy on activist groups. So, you know, an arms company is worried about some protesters, they buy the services of these companies, or environmental camps and things like that. So there's a sort of the official spies who have very little oversight anyway from the government. Then you have the unofficial spies, many of whom are former ex-spooks anyway. Doing all this stuff completely outside the law.
What would be the, to your knowledge, the split now between the official spies who are paid by the government and these contract spies?
MI5 in my day had about 2,000 full-time staff, and out of that there would probably be about 400 or 500 intelligence officers, and the rest were support staff. Now they have virtually doubled that number, but that's still quite a small organisation. And then of course you have the agents around that organisation who are infiltrating the groups. In terms of the commercial companies, they are massive. I mean, we're talking many, many large companies. And there have been a series of scandals over the last few years revealed in the UK press of people who have been caught out spying on these activist groups. So, you know, who can tell what's happening with meetings like this as well? Certainly in the UK, there may well be infiltration from MI5 agents. I would say there almost certainly would be infiltration from the police, because there's a sort of second tier of intelligence work in the UK where we have the secret police doing this sort of thing. And possibly as well, of course, these commercial spies. And they could actually all be running around treading on each other's toes as well, because
they normally don't know each other.
Exactly,
do they?
Exactly. Yeah. So they can cause each other problems as well.
That was Annie Machon, ex-MI5 officer and whistleblower, speaking in Canada to Barry Zwicker last year. I thought that was quite interesting, Martin, that there are four different ways that these intelligence people use to sort of persuade people to do what they want them to do: money, idealism, blackmail, and ego. What are your thoughts about what we've heard there, particularly to do with this privatisation of the intelligence Annie's talking about? With people who've been trained up by the state, then going and setting up their own little private intelligence company.
Well, the problem is that none of us really know what goes on in this world. We've just been given a little peek into it by Annie there, explaining some of what she knows. But of course, the whole purpose of intelligence operations is that most people don't know what's going on. And of course, you don't necessarily know, if you're an intelligence agent, what else is going on in your organisation. I mean, she and David Shaler resigned from MI5 because they came across operations which they thought were unethical. I'd just like to pick up on the earlier things that she was saying. The Islamic Fighting Group, which was being paid by MI6 to assassinate Colonel Gaddafi, was the Libyan branch of Al-Qaeda. So we've got a clear linkage between the British intelligence services cooperating with Al-Qaeda. This is long before the bombings of September the 11th or 7/7. Most of these Islamic jihadi groups were set up in the 80s under Operation Cyclone to fight inside Afghanistan. Head of Operation Cyclone in the CIA at the time was Robert Gates. He is still the US Defense Secretary. This is the sort of thing that people really need to take on board. These Islamic groups are actually a creature of the Western intelligence services. At what point did they go rogue, if they ever did go rogue?
Now, Adrian, before we finish, I wonder if you could just tell us about what your website is. And I also would just like to add that there is actually quite a lot of films around. I mean, Costa Gavras is the head of the French National Film Institute. He made a lot of films about this kind of thing going on in South America in the 1960s and 1970s. But what websites would you recommend, and your own one, obviously, Adrian, for people if people want to follow this up?
Well, first of all, I'd like to encourage people to investigate 7/7 for themselves. And July7th.co.uk is a website of some people I know that's very good. My website is officialconfusion.com, where you can find information about the bombs at Russell Square, Aldgate, Edgware Road, and of course a bus at Tavistock Square, and much, much more. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7 o'clock. After that, Friday night is music night. Stand by for our mashup, and up and up and up to the weekend. You'll be in the capable hands of the lovely Sam, a.k.a. DJ Spungold. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM. If you have a story for us, questions about this evening's programme, or would like to suggest a guest for a future show, please go to our webpage thisweek.org.uk or email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to this week's guest in the first hour, Conservative MP for Bristol North West, Charlotte Leslie. Thanks too to Marina Morris, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, and of course, local researcher and investigative filmmaker Adrian Connock. Next week, more conspiracy facts. We'll be quitting.